supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. A coalition of roughly 30 left-leaning organizations gathered near Independence Mall today for a Martin Luther King Day march. They put forward a progressive agenda for the coming years and stress unity as Donald Trump prepares to move into the White House. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arant was on the scene.
The crisp January air carried the sounds of protests past.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome.
And the sounds of protests present.
We're going to shut it down.
Shut it down.
We're going to shut it down.
Shut it down.
The hope was to unify old and new, black and white, and forge a new left coalition that can stand up to Washington under single-party control, or at least make its voice heard. The march's participants included labor unions, student activists, environmentalists, leaders from the Black Lives Matter movement, and clergy. Bishop Dwayne Royster now works with PICO, a national network of progressive religious organizations. He's well known in Philadelphia for his previous work leading the interfaith group Power.
We only win when we form multiracial, multi-faith coalitions of people that are determined to hear one another and love one another and walk with one another to change the damn world!
But can a common enemy unite the political left? At least 1,000 people marched, organizers say about 2,500. That's significantly fewer than when a similar event was held 2 years ago. The march was briefly disrupted by a man known widely as Philly Jesus, who wanders the city in clothing right out of the Bible. He insisted on marching at the front of the procession. Organizers tried to block him and largely treated him gently. But Black Lives Matter activist Asa Khalif threatened retaliation.
Black Lives Matter, we're going to see you very soon. Get thee behind me, Satan, but we're going to get behind you.
The varied reactions to Philly Jesus encapsulate unresolved questions for progressives. How militant is too militant? How passive is too passive? In fact, those were the very issues Dr. King and others debated back in their day. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arant, WHYY News.
Delaware Governor Jack Markell leaves office after 8 years tomorrow. One area the governor focused on during his term was in the area of fairness to all ethnic groups. WHYY's Nichelle Paulson reports from the Delaware desk on Governor Markell's resolution apologizing for slavery.
We have to speak up and we have to do. Yes. And that is what this is all about.
Delaware Governor Jack Markell has spent the last 8 years doing more than just focusing on the economy and education. He worked on race relations and bringing black and white people together. An example is legislation officially apologizing for slavery in Delaware, says Markell.
So there was a number of community people who came and asked me to issue the apology, sort of unilaterally as governor. I was willing to do it on my own, but I thought it was stronger if the General Assembly with the governor acted.
How did that start? And some people thought it was a great idea. Others thought it was bogus.
To think that this resolves all of our problems, or to think that this is the checking of the box and we don't have to worry about these issues anymore, is sort of ridiculous.
Outside of the apology, Governor Markell says he participated in a series of discussions that focus on race and civil rights.
As somebody who recognizes that there's no way we can possibly thrive as a community unless all of us are working together and pulling together and advancing together, it is my hope that over time, and especially as, you know, younger people rise in positions of power, we can, you know, continue to put some of these issues behind us.
So as governor, you travel throughout the state often. Do you find the discussion on race is different in Newcastle County versus Sussex? And I only ask this because a producer here said, hey, we still see the Confederate flag in parts of Sussex County. I know they're not on state buildings,
right,
or state properties, but with that apology, mm-hmm, does it make sense to have the state flag flying next to those properties that still fly the Confederate?
Yeah, so the question is a discussion very different? I think there are people of goodwill, good faith in every one of our 57 towns, mm-hmm, and throughout our unincorporated areas as well. And I believe that because I know. Are there people who harbor different views? there are. And they also probably exist in, you know, many of our towns and throughout the state. And that's sort of the way it goes.
But bottom line, Markell says such conversations have to start somewhere.
And so whether it is related to education, whether it's related to criminal justice, where our prisons are disproportionately populated by people of color, whether it's in the issue of health and the disparities we see there, we have plenty still to do, and the communities themselves have plenty still to do.
The entire interview with Governor Markell can be found at WHYY.org/first. From the Delaware desk, Nichelle Polston, WHYY News.
Nicodemo Little Nicky Scarfo, the tyrannical mob boss who ruled the Philadelphia underworld in the 80s, died while serving a 55-year prison sentence at a federal medical center in North Carolina over the weekend. He was 87 years old. Joining us to talk about Little Nicky Scarfo's impact on the La Cosa Nostra in Philadelphia is George Anastasia, a former writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, currently at BigTrial.net. George, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
So, George, for the generation like my producer, Brett, who is in his 20s, they never really knew about the mob in Philadelphia. Give us a thumbnail sketch of what Philadelphia's version of The Sopranos was like in real life.
You know, the Cosa Nostra was the dominant organization in the underworld, probably from the 50s through the 1990s. It's certainly in demise right now. But during Scarfo's era in the 1980s, it was probably one of the most violent underworld organizations ever to operate in Philadelphia. He certainly was the most violent mob boss. And it was part of the national syndicate, the Cosa Nostra, that it extends through about 26, 27 cities.
When you look at the mob during Little Nicky's reign, it was probably the most violent of all the mafia.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. He was certainly, I think, the most violent mob boss in the history of Philadelphia and probably one of the most violent mob bosses ever in America. He basically brought about the demise of his organization through his wanton use of violence. He was the antithesis of Angelo Bruno, who was the boss from 1959 to 1980. Bruno's idea was murder was a negotiating tool of last resort, with Scarfo, murder was a calling card.
Would you say when Scarfo was boss, it was the beginning of the end for the mafia in Philadelphia?
I don't think there's any doubt about that. He brought about the demise of the organization. Here's what happened. He dealt any problem, small, large, whatever, he dealt with it violently and with murder. And when a couple of his own members realized they had fallen out of favor and suspected, I think correctly, they were marked for death, the only place they could go was to the government, and they became cooperating witnesses. And that kind of started to snowball. There was one point in the mid to late 1980s where Philadelphia probably had more mob cooperators than any other city in America, and it was because of Scarfo. There was no reasoning with him.
And Scarfo's been in prison serving a 55-year term for how long?
He got arrested in January of 1987, so exactly 30 years. He spent the last 30 years of his life in federal facilities.
What does this mean for the current version of La Cosa Nostra in Philadelphia?
Probably nothing at all. I mean, he was never coming home. Scarfo was scheduled for parole in 2033, so he was never going to be a factor again.
George, do you expect a funeral in Philadelphia?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't have any details yet, but I'm being told it would be, if there's a funeral, it probably will be in the Atlantic City, Atlantic County area, and the last I heard, there's a strong possibility that it's going to be a private service. So I don't think it'll have the flair and the hoopla that a lot of different mob funerals have had in the past. I mean, when Angelo Bruno was buried in Philadelphia, it was an event. Everyone was out there. I don't think we're going to see that this time.
George Anastasia writes for BigTrial.net. Thank you very much for joining us here on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you very much.
A view of the night sky offers little evidence of the dynamic universe that changes both incrementally and at times violently. Now, an astronomer may have honed in on a collision of two stars that will be observed in 5 to 7 years. In this week's edition of Sky Talk, Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, joins NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller to make sense of the event.
Derek, this seems like a very chance opportunity to see science in the making on an astronomical level.
You're right. This is a one-in-a-million opportunity to capture an event like this, because the way astronomy is done in an effort to try to understand the evolution of phenomena and objects really has to be done snapshot by snapshot, because of the fact that most of these phenomena and activities take place over such a long period of time. So here is a situation in which two stars in what's called a binary system are close enough to each other, and it looks as if there could be a collision of the two not too long from now, and a group of astronomers have been able to identify what's happening leading up to, they believe, what's going to take place sometime between 2021 and 2023.
Very interesting stars.
Yes, indeed, they are very interesting stars. So when you look at this pair, what's really fascinating about them is, first of all, as a binary pair, they orbit a common orbiting point. And because of the proximity of the stars to each other, which is so close that they share an atmosphere or are touching in a way, that point of rotation between the two is actually inside that connection point, okay? So then the other thing about this is that both of these stars are now shaped like teardrops as they sort of come together. So think of them as two figure skaters working together, doing a spin, holding hands. Well, the common point between the two skaters is where they hold hands, and each one of them represents one of these stars.
How fast is that spin?
It's mind-bogglingly fast. Two stars orbiting a common point once every 11 hours.
If we are lucky enough to observe this collision, what will be the result?
More than likely, there's going to be a very, very large explosion of these two coming together, and the masses of these indicate that that will be the case. And in fact, observations already show that the orbital period between the two has been getting shorter and shorter over the last 5 years.
Derek, let's talk about leftovers in our solar system. There is increasing evidence of a ninth planet way beyond the first eight that we know. And now there's some sense that it's not unusual for solar systems, including ours, to have had several so-called rogue bodies.
So here we have, last year, identified some specific phenomena occurring to objects, Kuiper Belt objects as they're called, small planet-like objects out at the edge of our solar system that could only be caused by the gravitational effect of a much larger body. And in this case, astronomers have identified that this object must be 10 times the mass of our planet Earth, 4 times the actual size, and orbiting at an incredible distance away from the sun, 1,000 times the distance from Earth to the sun. So it's way out there. The chore in the next several years, hopefully perhaps this year, is to actually locate it and observe it. Now, this connects to the other phenomenon of, what is this object really? Is it an original member of our solar system that we haven't been able to detect, or is it what astronomers sometimes identify as rogue planets? Objects that are pulled by the gravitational field of a solar system. They pull these objects in. They become sort of like renegades within the solar system, and then for various dynamic reasons, don't stay. And we've been able to identify that indeed, at some point in the early history of our solar system, we had some rogue activity going on. Lots of larger objects making their way through our solar system, pulling, dragging, pushing other objects around until the final ejection of those things through the dynamic process allowed our solar system to come into the arrangement and organization that we have now.
Fascinating, this notion of the construction and architecture of a solar system. Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, time.
The Schuylkill River provides drinking water to 1.5 million people. It's carried a lot of pollutants over the past several hundred years, including industrial waste, sewage, pesticide runoff from farmlands, and it's certainly cleaner than it was 50 years ago. But a new art installation at the University of Pennsylvania demonstrates the impact of pollution through sound. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips recently took a look.
At the Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts on Penn's campus, off to the side in the lobby area, is a small installation called Datum. Immediately, you are drawn to five friendly faces, elders, active in the decades-long struggle to clean up the Schuylkill River. Their warm smiles are next to a video projection of sun shimmering on the river's surface. But pick up a set of headphones and you hear this.
My name is Danielle Taroni, and I'm a landscape architect and an artist.
Taroni's contribution to the installation is called Peak Discharge. She put a hydrophone beneath the river at a stormwater discharge point near Amtrak's 30th Street Station. Using discharge data from the U.S. Geological Survey, she programmed a delay in the recording based on the amount of water rushing into the river. With that discharged water comes pollutants that have been picked up from streets, parking lots, and sewers.
So more delay means more discharge.
Yes, yes.
Sounds kind of like a train running through.
Yeah, it's weird.
And what are those clanking sounds?
Those are bubbles. Just for me, this is a more of a political statement, honestly. This is what we're doing to our land. This is what we're doing to our water.
So how would it sound if we weren't doing these things?
If we weren't doing this, it sounds nice. It's beautiful bubbles and soft, natural sounds.
So when it gets really distorted, what are the types of things that are flowing into our river that aren't so good?
It could be any number of different pollutants. But unfortunately, what I realized while researching for this project is that there is no pollutant load data for the lower Schuylkill River, which is pretty surprising.
When you say that you feel an emotion when you hear this distorted sound, are you assuming that everyone's going to feel the same emotion?
I would think so. Has a big impact, at least for me, emotionally.
And what is that emotion? You're grimacing.
I am grimacing. I don't know, it's like terror and fear and facing destruction of our environment.
State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reporting. The installation will be at Penn's Annenberg Center until February 9th. Once deemed Britain's most influential comedian, actor John Cleese has broken the mold made for comedians in his decades-long career by exploring psychology, politics, and even business training. Cleese regularly embarks on speaking tours, allowing audience members to ask any question they have, no matter how invasive. NewsWorks Tonight, Dave Heller spoke with the Monty Python founding member ahead of his engagement for the Philadelphia Speaker Series tonight.
16 stops in 17 days?
Well, the thing is, it's only the traveling that makes all difficult, because going out in front of an audience is actually very pleasurable. And I'll tell you why. The people who like Python and that sort of stuff, they're nice people. They have a sense of humor and they love to laugh and they're friendly, because if they didn't like my stuff, they wouldn't buy tickets. So that the audience is pre-selected to think that the sort of stuff I do is funny and pre-selected to like me personally. So the whole thing is great fun, and we can finish up talking about absolutely anything that anyone wants to talk about, and nothing is out of bounds.
Well, because you cited Monty Python, I've heard you in past interviews differentiate between the response of American versus British fans of that series when they encounter you now.
There are differences. For example, the Americans love The Holy Grail. They think that's our best film, whereas I'm pretty sure, and I think most of the other Pythons are, that Life of Brian is a better film. But I don't think that the sense of humor is very different. I think the sense of humor varies more within the United States, because you do have big areas in the Midwest and the South where people really don't get irony. And if they don't get irony, they're not really going to laugh at Monty Python. But the moment you get to either the East Coast or the West Coast or the Great Lakes or, of course, big cities like we had wonderful receptions recently in Houston and in Dallas. When you're in big cities, and you know, people are more sophisticated and they get irony. So in those areas, we do very well. But if we go out into the sticks, then you can tell that the audience just doesn't laugh as much or doesn't laugh as quickly. And yet, the funny thing is, at the very end of the performance, they give you just as good a reception. It's as though they've enjoyed it in their own quiet way. But obviously, the more responsive audiences are much more fun to play to.
John, we've been referring to irony, but it's irony cum absurdist when you think of the Monty Python pratfall sketches and such. And it was always based in large measure on poking fun at the status quo and convention. Well, be careful what you wish for. First Brexit and then our election here.
Yes, but you see, Americans assume that Brexit is a bad thing. And I don't know why. It's as though they haven't heard the arguments for it. I mean, I was in favor of it, not strongly, because I thought both campaigns were absolutely awful, and I didn't believe many of the claims made by either party. So when you read anywhere in the press, it's consumed that Brexit must be a bad thing. And I don't know why Americans assume that.
People are typically more comfortable with the status quo and perhaps not even just implications for Britain, but the European Union at large.
Yes, but you see, you haven't suffered under the European Union. My description of the European Union would be 5,000 bureaucrats telling people what to do, what kind of apples they can eat. And the bureaucrats wanted to build Europe up into a superstate. Some of them, the Germans, for example, wanted to have a European army. Well, nobody's voted for that, but the bureaucrats were in the process of trying to create it. It's one of the things Lord David Owen pointed out. We don't want a European army, so bureaucrats in Brussels, please stop trying to create one.
You say you're open to any questions during your appearance here in Philadelphia. What, though, if somebody asks you about your upcoming role portraying a fairy godmother?
It's the most fun I think I ever had. I love doing voices for animated cartoons. Because it's so civilized. Oh, you go into a nice, warm, dry studio. You don't have to learn the lines because they're on a card in front of you. You don't have to shave. They've got coffee there if you wanted. And then you get these lovely scripts, which they spend more time on than they do on ordinary real-life movies. They ponder the script. And if you're working, as I was lucky enough to do, the people with Shrek, I mean, these people really know what they're doing. And they say, could you try this? Could you try that? Make it a bit more angry, tie it a bit slower. And then they say, well, do you have any idea? So by the time you finish, you've got so many lines on tape that they're not going to choose a bad one. So you kind of feel protected against failure.
Coffee, warm and comfort. Then what is the allure of coming to the United States in the dead of winter?
People often ask me that. They say, why did you do this or why did you do that? And the answer is because someone asked me. If they'd asked me to do this in May, I would have been happier. But I'm delighted to do it now. And if it cheers people up who are feeling rather cold, then I've done something useful.
Well, we're delighted to have had you hold forth on NewsWorks tonight. Thanks so much.
A great pleasure. I hope I didn't annoy anyone.
John Cleese, and you'll be able to hear him at the Philadelphia Speaker Series appearance here in Philadelphia. When you're
chewing on life's gristle. A longer version of their conversation can be heard at newsworks.org, including an absurdist mini-episode of Sky Talk between John Cleese and a giddy Derek Pitts. Finally tonight, a Bruce Springsteen cover band is not just playing his music, they're covering his politics as well. Amid a storm of emails from both sides of the aisle, members of B Street Band have announced they will no longer be playing the Garden State Presidential Inaugural Gala in Washington, D.C. The group played the gig for President Obama's inauguration with no controversy and signed on for this year's gala in 2013 before there was any serious rumblings of presidential nominees. The decision to drop out was purely out of respect to the boss, an outspoken detractor of President-elect Donald Trump. The B Street Band's keyboardist, Will Forte, said, "We felt that we had to make it known that we didn't want to seem disrespectful in any way or form to Bruce and his music and his band." That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Binakoff, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom McDonald for NewsWorks Tonight.